good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Environmental Law Institute. My name is Alejandra Rabasa. I am director of the Inter-American Program. We are pleased to welcome you to today's discussion on small and environmental protection in Peru. As our panelists will discuss, the government of Peru recently passed a law intended to support investment in energy, energy and mining that would, among other things, weaken the of these sectors. Peru is one of the largest gold producing countries in the world, with thousands of miners engaged in artisanal small-scale gold mining activities. The new law raises a host of questions about environmental protection in Peru, including with the gold mining sector. We look forward to a robust discussion about the law's implications for biodiversity and protected areas, its effects on the artisanal small-scale gold mining sector, and the future of environmental institutions in Peru. Our research associate, Narayan, for helping us to organize today's event. And we'll turn it over to my colleague, Lisa Goldman, senior attorney at ELI, to introduce our panelists. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks. And just briefly, we have first speaking will be Monica Nunez-Salas. I hope I don't butcher too much of your bio with my non-Spanish accent. She's a legal advisor at the Peruvian Agency for Assessment and Environmental Control. She formerly the Environmental Sanctioning Procedures Office at that same agency, and now she works on supervising and training environmental officials throughout Peru, including at the local government level, as well as officials, environmental officials with other ministries. She's actually here participating in two environmental leadership programs, one at Berkeley and the other at Stanford. So we're happy to have her here for a couple of months. And she holds a law degree from Pontificia Universidad Católica del Perú.
Yes.
That was it. And we are also very pleased to have Hannah Stutzman with us, who is Director of Programs at the Amazon Conservation Association, where she manages the Manu Tambopata Corridor Project and the Cusco-based Indigenous Red Project. She also helps to design new programs and strategies. She has worked in conservation, sustainable development, and cultural issues with major NGOs in the U.S. as well as Latin America. While living recently in Bogota, Colombia, she worked with Conservation International and the Colombian Ministry of Culture. She holds a Master's of Environmental Management from Yale University, as well as a BA in Anthropology from Bryn Mawr College. So thanks again for coming, everyone. We'll have Monica speak first, then Hannah, then we hope to have some questions and answers and a very fruitful discussion. Thanks again.
Hi, can everyone hear me okay, or should I use the mic? Good. Well, the broad question that we were asked to address here today was, what will this new legislation bring? We're all aware of what Alejandra said. Peruvian government has recently passed a legislation that is aimed to reactivate economy, because we've had a bit of a slowdown on the recent months. First, I want to give you a bigger scope of what the current situation in Peru is regarding mining, and then we'll go to the new changes that the legislation has brought. So the environmental sector in Peru is headed by the Ministry of Environment, recently created in 2008. It has some agencies adscribed to them. The most important ones for this issue are OEFA, is the agency I work for, and CERNAMP, which is the one that's related to the national protected areas. They're the most affected ones through this legislation. Mining activity in Peru is divided into four sectors. The large scale and medium scale mining are supervised and controlled by OEFA, which is a central government agency, and small scale mining and artisanal mining are directly supervised by regional governments throughout Peru. The problem we are facing now is that artisanal small-scale mining, due to the increase in the price of gold, have been using inadequate machinery and do not comply with technical and legal standards. They've grown to medium and large scale sizes, but they are not complying with the environmental standards that are currently asked for this size of sort of mining. This has given us a new definition of what we're calling illegal and informal mining. They both are strata of mining that are using inadequate machinery and do not comply with technical legal standards or do not have an environmental permit to develop activity. However, informal miners are under the law right now because the government started a formalization process for them, which will end up granting them an operation to continue activity through this formalization thing. And however, the illegal miners are developing their activities in prohibited areas and are not subject to formalization. So this is something we want to eradicate from the mining activities. Regarding informal mining, the formalization process started by the government has five different steps. The first one involved signing a sworn commitment during a term comprehended between April 2012 and the next 30 days. 70,000 miners subscribed this sworn commitment, and this gave us information about how this informal mining was being developed and how much of them were the activity in a broader scale. Because we have this criteria for determining who, like sometimes families work together or they have companies and they have little rights, but since they work together, it turns into a bigger project and it grows up to a medium, more large scale mining. Then the second step is acquiring mining rights. We should take into account that obtaining a mining right or a mining concession does not give authority the permit to develop mining activity. However, they're asked to obtain, most of them do not have a mining concession or a mining assignment through a concession or an exploitation permit. However, from the first step to the second one, in the sworn commitment, we had like 70,000 miners involved signing this commitment. But however, to obtaining mining rights, we only had like 3.88% of this 70,000 miners do actually accredit having the mining rights. The third and fourth step, the next step was obtaining surface above the concession, water and environmental permits, and developing an environmental impact assessment, statement, a declaration, or a whole study. This was very conflicting. At first, they gave the authorities gave a term that was due on February 2013. Then they extended it to October 2013, and now, and then they just hold deadline for obtaining these permits, and they did like a broad deadline through the end of the process that was due on April 19th this year. However, before that deadline, the authorities in Peru created a new process that's called the sanitation process, and it's due 2016. So informal mining got an extension of 2 years to keep the activities. It is like, which is questionable, actually. This is supposed to end up in granting them an authorization for mining activity, which we're waiting for in 2016. Regarding illegal mining, it has a whole different treatment. The government has implemented both administrative and criminal measures, which regard the formalization process, more strict fiscalization, of illegal miners and, well, small artisanal and informal miners, which can develop their activities up to an illegal level. There's a control on fuel and different insumos?
Supplies?
Different supplies they need for mining. And the interesting part is, remember I told you how from the sewer commitments we could tell that there were small and artisanal miners that were to a medium or large scale level. So OEFA, the agency for assessment and control, has been starting sanctioning procedures to this so-called artisanal and small scale miners who we can detect that on a bigger level. Regarding the criminal measures, there have been criminalization of illegal mining, an area in the presidency of the Minister Council created specially for illegal mining, and the actions of interdiction, which imply destroying and confiscating machinery used for illegal activities. So what changes has this, under this scope, Peru has been growing with a Peru's economy has been growing with a 6% annual rate for the last 3 years, but this year we had a bit of a reduction, and we're growing only in a 4% economic rate, which has scared a lot of our economic authorities, and they decided that it was a time to reactivate economy and to focus on like more friendlier policies for economic growth. This got us to the regulation, the law 3230, which was promulgated on July 12th this year, and it brought new changes towards taxation, customs, and mainly environmental policies. I'm gonna address four of them, which are like probably the less popular ones. One implied a penalty reduction for the fines that OEFA could impose to medium and large scale mining. The second, it all changes to one. I'm sorry about the numbering. The second one involved a change in the process to declare a natural protected area. The third one is regarding the term that authorities have to give technical opinions in order to approve an environmental impact assessment. And the fourth is related to the process for approving maximum permissible limits and environmental quality standards. So a little background of what OEFA has been doing since it was created. It was created along in 2008, but did not acquire mining competencies until 2010. It has inherited a lot of administrative procedures from the previous environmental agencies in mining, energy, industry sectors, and also fishery. In a total, up to 2013, the agency has imposed 845 sanctions from the previous environmental agencies and the processes it inherited from them, and only 96 from direct supervisions developed by OEFA itself. It has, up to 2014, it has developed 5,517 direct supervisions over, well, mining, energy, fishery activities, and only 96 of these supervisions have led to an environmental sanctioning procedure with a sanction at the end. The maximum sanction that OEFA can impose is of about $40,700,000, which is a new regulation that was approved a couple years ago. However, this is only applicable to harmful illegal activities, which means activities in mining that are being developed without an environmental permit and that cause objective and like provable harmful activities over health and environment. However, this sanction has not been we have never imposed a sanction this high, and the average sanctions imposed of all this all the numbers I gave you before is of 92,000, which is pretty conservative. And though this has been happening, a lot of the authorities in Peru and the economic sectors are calling OEFA a bit of an exaggerated regulator. The regulation has established a three years term to privilege prevention and correction and do only exception and sanctioning, which means we're gonna do the supervision over direct supervision over activities. Environmental legal procedures, sanctioning procedures will only be started exceptionally, and if an infraction, like an environmental infraction, is determined, it modified the procedure so that if a responsibility is determined, you do not impose a sanction, but you only give preventive remediation and correction indications for the minor activity or however activity is regulated, And then if they do not fulfill this corrective measurements, then you can impose a sanction which has been cut to 50% of the valued amount. That is 50%, and only under exceptional procedures that have been modified recently. Except for those in which you can determine objectively there was a severe damage or activities or repetitive infractions in a term of 6 months. So there is an exception. And also this 50% is only applied to the valued sanctions. So you follow like an economic of what the costs should be. But there are also other sanctions that are already fixed. If you want, like, I don't know if I'm doing this correctly. There are fixed sanctions which are not cut off to this 50%, but only the ones that have to go to the economic analysis before this. That's regarding NOEFA. Then the natural protected areas have also been modified. The usual procedure for establishing a natural protected area was first you find an area worth of protection. If you do have the technical studies to accredit, it is possible to declare it as a natural protected area. You follow the procedure, and through a supreme decree, you declare it as a natural protected area. However, if you find an area worth of protection and do not have the technical studies to qualify it as a natural protected area yet, the environmental authority was entitled to declare it as a reserved zone for a determined amount of time before you do the through which you do the technical studies, and then you can transform it or declare it as a natural protected area. So it used to be a ministerial decision only regarding the Ministry of Environment, and then in order to declare it as a natural protected area, you needed all other sectors and all our ministers to discuss and sign a supreme decree approved by a Council of Ministers. However, with the new regulation, the possibility of declaring it a reserved zone through a ministerial decision has been changed, and now you have the Ministry of Environment needs to involve all other sectors which have their own economic interest in the areas, because most the discussion is mostly regarding oil extraction, because a lot of supplies for oil have been found near the Amazon in areas that are that we're thinking of transforming into natural protected areas. So now you cannot do this previous stage in which you declare it as a reserve zone while you study it, but you have to take it to the environmental authority has to take it to the Council of Ministers in order to declare it as a reserved zone. This is bad. This is for the binding, I'm sorry about the slide. This is for the binding and not binding For the technical opinions, the sectorial authority is in charge of approving the environmental impact assessments, and sometimes it has to address the environmental authority in order to obtain a binding or not binding technical opinion before approving the assessment. So what they have stated in this new regulation is they only have a 45 days term, subject to functional responsibility for the for the government authorities that have to do give the opinion, and they have what they have done is like this is a more strict term for giving the technical opinion, but it does not actually change the term they had before. It's just exposing more the responsibility that government officials have for giving these technical opinions. And the last one is it has regarding maximum permissible limits and environmental quality standards. It used to be of the Ministry of Environment to approve the environmental standards, but it always involved all the other economic sectors that had to do with the standards approved. So even though the Ministry of Environment approved it by a ministerial decision itself, it went under consultation before approving the law. So they did, I mean, we always had all the other sector authorities involved in this, in the approval of these standards. However, they've changed it now. And instead of having the Ministry of Environment approving through a ministerial decision, it's changed to a supreme decree, which means all the sectors, economic sectors involved have to also assign the same law and approve it as a decision of the whole minister council. It is not a big change in practice, but formally it is a whole different bureaucracy for approving these environmental standards, and it is a whole mix of economic interests when you do this. And well, this is about what I'm gonna address. Thanks.
So I'm just gonna a bit more specifically about the context in the region of Madre de Dios, which I think a lot of you know has sort of been the epicenter of illegal and informal small-scale gold mining in Peru. And I'd like to preface it by saying I'm not a lawyer. So I'll do my best to talk about the legal pieces of this, but I'll also just provide a little bit of context about what's happening in the formalization process. And I also just added a few pictures of what the mining looks like. This is seen from above, I think in the sector of Guacamayo, and then this is on the ground in one of the illegal mining areas right outside of the Tambopata National Reserve. And then this is just taken from the Guacamayo area, and so you can see it just kind of looks like a desert. And it extends a couple of kilometers, and there's still the forest in the back there. And that has happened basically since 2009, and there's been some more complete analysis of how much deforestation has occurred in Madre de Dios from mining. And this is from Greg Asner's study published last year, where he did flyovers of the region with LIDAR, with a laser satellite imaging technology that allowed them to calculate in much greater detail how much had already been deforested. And it's about 123,000 acres at that point. And everything that's been deforested from mining, and then this is just since 2009. So you can see, you know, the big growth along the rivers and these two big areas that extend from either side of the Interoceanic. And it's expected that another analysis will come out and increase the deforestation figure to about 170,000 acres in the last. So an increase from the last 2 years. So this mining formalization process that Monica mentioned is taking place for miners that have established themselves in what has been designated the mining corridor within Madre de Dios. And so in 2010, it was designated, this is a map of the whole region of Madre de Dios, and much of it, of this portion of it, is held in protected areas. Manu is over here, and the Tambopata Reserve and Bawahasonene are here. The Oceanic Highway runs from Brazil along here, basically, and then out to Cusco. So this pink area is what was designated as a legal mining corridor where mining can happen, and miners have this option of signing the formalization process that Monica described. But of course, it turns out to be much more complex, because there are a lot of other existing land rights already within that designated corridor. So this is a map. There's sort of a lot going on, but this red line shows the extent of this mining corridor. The city of Puerto Maldonado is kind of over here. And then inside the corridor, all the different colors basically designate a different use on top of which mining concessions and mining activity is happening. So, and the biggest land use really here are different types of forestry concessions. So timber concessions, and then smaller scale concessions that are referred to concessions, but essentially operate as tiny timber concessions as well. And then there's also this kind of gray color that denotes smallholder agriculture for the most part, some of which is titled with prop and a big portion of which is not, which is another piece of the dilemma. And then on either side, it has these conservation areas. And then extending up here are more forestry concessions, but without the mining corridor overlapping them. And so this map is perhaps even harder to see, but indicates the next layer of complexity, basically. This is sort of the same mining corridor area with the same background types of land use and existing concessions and agricultural either usage or land rights. But then on top of it, I don't know if you guys can see, there are tiny yellow lines on top of everything. And those are the existing mining concessions. And then on top of that, there is actually yet another layer, which is the actual mining activity, which may or may not correspond to those concessions. The concessions are legally granted, but then in many of them, a miner may be operating without a formal agreement from that concessionaire. And then in addition to that, there has been new agricultural colonization of people looking for land rights that has also occurred kind of in that same area. And so it creates this many layers of complexity basically for determining land rights. And that's been a major challenge in the going through the steps of this formalization process. And this here finally is just that same mining corridor with the deforestation data that you saw before, and indicating kind of what of it falls in the corridor and what doesn't. And so this is the corridor, but you can see there's some big areas of deforestation that do fall into the Tambopata Reserve Buffer Zone, and that's part of what Monica referred to as mining that is totally illegal, whereas the mining inside the corridor could be part of this process. So, you know, Madre de Dios is a sort of small-scale version of exactly what Monica described of a
What's
happening in the whole country through the formalization process, where a big number of miners tried to enter in. Some number, there's not great official data, but probably about 5,000 entered into the first process with the declaration of commitment. And then in the second step, it's estimated about 1,800 passed into that, which is demonstrating either that they have a concession or a formal agreement with a concessionaire. So that they can operate. But then it's then a third step to demonstrate that if there is another land use, whether it's private property or a concession, that there is permission from that rights holder to operate there. And that's one of the big points of blockage, basically, of this formalization process. So far in Madre de Dios, no one has completed the formalization process. In the whole country, I think five people in Puno have completed it of the thousands that have started. And much of the slowdown is this land process, and there's sort of two legal pieces that have remained very much up in the air, one of which is affected by this new legislation, which is the ordenamiento territorial, or the land use planning process, has been sort of on hold, essentially, in Madre de Dios for at least the last year, probably a bit longer at this point. And it has been completed for all the areas of Madre de Dios except this mining corridor, essentially, because it's so politically difficult and unclear how exactly to advance with this step of creating ordenamiento territorial. And what this new law does is change a bit the process so that regional governments and the environment ministry still work together to produce a planning document. And previously, that then was approved by MINAM, and then they asked for a legal from Congress that turned that planning document into a land use planning tool, essentially, that was legally accepted. Now it's changed, and similar to sort of these other shifts, instead it will be decree. Rather than through this environment ministry process, and so it reduces a bit their authority there. But I think, despite that, you know, it was clear that there are some existing problems with how this process was not going forward in the region, regardless. And the second question is that there is no conflict resolution mechanism to decide what should happen when these two rights are on top of each other. And it seems like no one wants to be the responsible entity for having to decide what that is. And the kind of two options that seem like they're under discussion right now, at least in Madre Dios, are either that they could act like a consecutive property where the person who wants to mine has to get permission and a formal agreement from that rights holder to move forward, or they could have what's called servidumbre, and basically obligationaire to allow the miner to operate under the, you know, series of legal regulations that are required. And at one point, actually, the regional government put out an order saying that that's what they were going to do, and they authorized their take that action for concessionaires. But it was clear also that many functionaries within the government had some connections to miners, and that was overturned, I think, within a few days of its passage. And then since then, that question hasn't been resolved. And then there is a remaining question, which is that land use titling hasn't kept pace with acquired rights, and so there's a lot of particularly small farmers along the highway. SDA's most recent estimate was that 70% of these small farmers may or may not have some acquired legal rights because of the length of time they've been there and the activities they're doing to get a title, but the titling hasn't kept pace, basically, with that. And so there are a lot of instances of overlap where there's a conflict and no one has a clear title there, basically. And there hasn't been a mechanism to resolve those situations. And the regional government had created something called the Catastro Regional Único, like basically a single entity that was supposed to deal with titling and resolve the problem of there being agencies that didn't speak with each other, basically, to emit titles. But unfortunately, that was created and then essentially never opened, never entered into functioning. And so one potential solution to that's on the horizon is that just recently the regional government has created a new regional environmental authority. It was just authorized in June, and the sort of regulations for its operation are being reviewed now by a society and regional government partnership. And the idea is that it will absorb all the multiple environmental authority functions of the regional government, and hopefully also their budgets, although that's not yet clear. That will include the zoning, and it will also include this titling process. And so the goal is that maybe this titling process can restart through this new authority, but it's new enough that's not clear. And that authority is not really addressed in this new law. And I think just another point worth mentioning on the new law and its reception in Puerto Maldonado and in Madre Dios, you know, are what we see in Madre Dios is that there is kind of a perception that the formalization process won't happen and that maybe it's just a strategy to get rid of miners by making them tired, basically, by like so much bureaucracy that they give up and stop. And that even so Otsuka is the head of a miner federation and is one of the candidates for the regional government president, where there are elections this fall. He said that on the radio last week, and I think that echoes a perception, whether or not it's true and whether or not people agree with it. It's commonly heard in the region. And this new legislation, interestingly, didn't cause a lot of reaction from miners. It was kind of a shrug, because much of it really is aimed more at the medium and large scale miners, and the attitude is sort of, well, you know, we still have the formalization process, and this doesn't make that much difference to it. The same kind of reaction that there was to the formalization and sanitation processes that you mentioned, where there were university forums and groups of miners and people getting together to really do an assessment of the law. That hasn't occurred, and there's much more focus on the elections, what's going to happen with the formalization process, if anything, and how this land use situation will be resolved. And I think there's lots more to say, but yeah. I can leave it there, and maybe we can go to questions.
Before we get to questions, I don't know, I briefly want to ask Monica if there's anything you wanted to
we can take that chance now again, take questions, or if not, we can question you tomorrow.
Yeah, well, yes, the new regulation is aimed to encourage further investment from big and medium scale miners. How would this affect the formalization process? Some of the illegal or informal miners are working on a medium and large scale, so that this does work as a disincentive for the large and medium scale miners. It works as a disincentive to adopt new, more efficient technologies because your sanctions are already cut to half, and for the informal ones that may fall into this bigger categorization, it also works as a disincentive because the punishment will be harsh as it was planned before. Last year, the environmental agency was seen as a tiger. Like the main media was covering all the new strict regulations we were having, how it was becoming more environmentally conscious industry, how bigger, more strict standards were asked from our miners, and this year we're talking the opposite. So it does, I think it does influence the whole feeling of, you know, like economic growth. There's no, you're breaking the balance that you were once creating in a very new sector that is just like is gaining approval. The Ministry of Environment has been doing a very good like media output, very good communication with the public. Everyone was falling into the, everyone like in Peru is worried about the formalization process. We all know about illegal mining. We all know how disastrous it is. We want answers, not only the ones who work directly, but they're looking forward to obtaining rights, to having their rights cleared. But everyone is expecting our authorities to do this. And this has brought us a feeling that we're taking a couple steps back.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think this sort of civil society reaction in Peru or NGO reaction has very much been that even if for formalization these regulations aren't directed at the small scale mining, it creates an overall weakening of a lot of the institutions that need to strengthen this bigger formalization process to be able to actually do land rights and land use planning. But also the Park Service plays an important role here in managing the buffer zone of Tambopata, and as it, you know, as this focus sort of absorbs the limited resources of the Park Service, I think there's also a fear of how does that resource shift end up affecting places like this, even if, you know, their direct role in looking at mining isn't specifically changed by this legislation.
Few questions from the audience, if you can take some. And I also know that we have participants over the phone, people from SPDA, for example, Sociedad Peruana de Derecho Ambiental, Lenin Valencia is there, and he wants to participate. So we can open the floor for the audience, and then here, we need to make sure just that all the questions are
repeated into the mics,
so we can have the recording of everything.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just kind of a general question was, is this, I guess, going back process, could you comment, is it related to some kind of free trade agreement mechanism in the backdrop of this whole thing, in terms of weakening the institutional framework for formalization, not mining in general, and gold mining, which is specifically, you know, like you mentioned, one accident can be a catastrophe.
Just repeat the question.
Sure. Yeah. So the question was whether or not this rollback of environmental administrative authority is linked at all to a free trade agreement process.
Yeah.
So Environmental Investigation Agency actually came out with a statement about that, saying actually totally the opposite, that that this rollback actually violates the environmental regulations that are within the free trade agreement that Peru has negotiated with the U.S.
Yeah.
And that the response from the Peruvian government has been that that's not true, and I haven't seen more detail.
Yeah.
I don't know that more detail exists than that.
Well, yeah, actually, the Ministry of Environment was created in 2008, not directly, but yes, to the negotiations regarding the free trade agreement with the U.S. That was one of the things that was pushed forward as a requisite for entering this agreement. So yes, what she says is true. However, like Peruvian authorities may say this is only a 3-year regulation, which you can also question, because if you are a foreign investor, will you be more willing to invest in a country because they've only opened this 3-year more friendly regulation for investments? It's not like it's not permanent, so I guess they can probably shield themselves by saying that, but also like the question has not, I don't think it has been answered very deeply, and we're not questioning it a lot.
I can think about at least 2 free trade agreements that have been signed by Peru that literally say that the party shall not reduce environmental standards to attract trade or investment. I think that the implications of this economic package are, you know, yet to be seen, and in order for things to change, they would have to be tested in the mechanisms of the trade agreement for, you know, in courts. There are other mechanisms that I can, when I was hearing you make the presentation and talk about the protected areas, I was just thinking and talking to my colleague Max here about the Western Hemisphere Convention on Nature Protection that says that the parties, Peru is a party since 1946, will maintain these protected areas and this reserve, and will continue establishing new ones. And it also says that national parks shall not be subject of commercial exploitation. So the question here is, you know, maybe the law is not a direct violation to the text of the treaty, but the motives of the law could be potentially in conflict, because what happens with the areas that are already, you know, established, or not establishing those certain areas just to attract, you know, mining activities or mm-hmm. commercial activities in all of these reserves.
There's a thing that, like, through this regulation, we have not yet relaxed our environmental standards. It's mostly about processes, how they've changed, and they've, you can say, eased out the process for creating natural protected areas, the process for approving regulations. But the regulations themselves have not been changed by this law. However, as you say, we're yet about to see what changes, right? Because regarding mostly the environmental standards, the LMPs and the environmental quality standards, once that they're put out to the Minister Council, instead of just having the environmental authority approving them, maybe, I mean, since there are other interests involved, they could change and they could relax these standards. But this regulation itself does not do it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of concern, though, that the motive is to make these processes, especially for protected area declaration, more political and less technical,
mm-hmm.
essentially.
Yeah. I just have 2 points of clarification. The first point is about, you know, the distinction between informal and illegal.
Yes.
So as I understood, there's, you know, one issue is about the area where the mining is being conducted, whether it's within the allowed corridor or not.
Mm-hmm.
But was I correct in understanding it's also with regard to whether they're literally small versus medium?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question about that is, you know, what if someone's operating in the mining corridor and they want to formalize, but they're a medium scale mine,
mm-hmm.
are they allowed to apply for a permit as a medium scale mine in that case, or is that they're by declaration illegal?
Sorry,
can you please repeat the question?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, so if I understood correctly, So what happens to the miners that are working in the mining corridor, which is a permitted area, but they are working at a medium or large applied to the formalization process as well? Mm-hmm. Well, the answer is no, because the formalization process is only for artisanal and small-scale miners. If you are a medium or a large scale, you should be operating. Like, this is an exceptional. Peruvian regulations have only foreseen these four scales: artisanal, small, medium, and large. You may have mining, you may have land rights, but you are not authorized to operate until the administrative and the environmental permits. And there are regulations for the administrative and environmental permits for each strata. There are easier to obtain for small and artisanal miners. However, these artisanal miners that are not formal, they do not have the permits, have been given an exceptional opportunity to formalize their activities. They can only do so if they comply with the permits that have been stated, the first of which is to be working in an artisanal or a small scale. So if you're a medium, you're already illegal because you're without a permit. You cannot go to the formalization process. That is why, from the information obtained from the sworn statements, the Agency for Assessment and Control, which I think has started, I don't know the name in English, has started some sanctioning procedures for those who are working in a bigger scale and are under its supervision. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah. So I understand what you said, but can they then apply for a permit under
yes.
the regulations that permit medium scale mining?
Yeah. How do you formalize medium activity that does not have the? You have to go through the whole process that a normal medium investor would. You have to acquire. It's the same thing, but at a larger scale. Acquire the concession rights. Acquire the surface rights. You can, if you're a medium scale, you cannot do, like, there's an exceptional environmental permit that's called EGAC. Environmental impact. It would
is
be like environmental
instrument.
Correct. Yeah, like a corrective instrument, which is the instrument that will be approved at the end of this formalization process, exceptionally, that this opportunity has been created exceptionally for small and artisanal scale miners. If you're a medium or a large scale, you cannot use this corrective instrument. You have to do the regular EIA, which is bigger, like a bigger scale, and you have to undertake actions that a bigger mining scale does. So it's not under the formalization process, but through the regular one. And still, even if you start that formalization process, you're already committing like environmental infractions. So you're already subject to sanctions and fines for the activity you have been developing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks.
It just happened, a number of the 70,000 that put in their declaration of compromiso
mm-hmm.
were rejected because they were found to be medium scale,
mm-hmm.
not small scale. So my question, you say Lenin from SPD is on
yeah,
the
yeah. Who knows
so
more than we do?
This
yes.
might be good for him too. Is so that April 19th formalization deadline.
Yeah.
Then the next day started this Sanamiento
mm-hmm.
process. That we've had a hard time defining, actually. I don't know if sanitation is the right translation, but we don't know how to translate
yeah.
it either. But from what we understand, it's so they've had 120 days to try to figure out how to fix those steps 2, 3,
mm-hmm.
4, and 5. And if my math's correct, that comes out to about nowish time, so end of August. My question is if anyone has any idea of what is getting ready to come out, because so I work with Hannah at ACA, by the way, and so we put out these little plugs, we put out these periodic watch, we track what's happening in the Peruvian mining sector, and we put out these these updates every 2 or 3, 4 weeks. So if anyone's interested in getting them, let me know, and we can add you to our email list. But it's been really quiet the past 4 months, because there used to be lots and lots of news about this formulation process, but then it got really quiet. And so I'm envisioning pretty soon there's going to be this explosion of news and regulations and just basically new regulations that are aimed at the one that Hannah was talking about the overlap. So I guess my question is just, does anyone know, like me or Lennon, like, does anyone know about what's coming in terms of like this array of possible legislation that's come out after 120 days to fix these steps 2, 3, 4, 5?
Yeah. No? I agree. Like, the agency I work with is not directly involved, so I would do the same.
I'll just repeat the question. I think given that the formalization process ended on April 19th, and then the new saneamiento process started on the 20th, and was to have 120 days to emit new regulations to solve the problems with the formalization process. Does anyone know what's about to happen?
Which we don't.
No. Lennon.
Yeah.
Are you there?
Hi. Yeah.
Do you have any insight?
I know well about what is going to happen with the 120 days.
Yeah, and the improvement of this proceso de saneamiento.
Exactly. Well, I can give you brief comments about that. Well, basically, it has continued. There has been a focus on Madre de Dios, basically. There's a development plan that the government is trying to develop to let's say, create an alternative vision. But I would say my general assessment is that the process is going in a very slow way. The focus is more in interdictions or like the use of to destroy machinery, especially in the National Reserve of Tambopata. But other issues like to faster the process of formation, in my view, are not going very well. They have until August, until October to complete the plan that will apply in the next 2 years. But for me, it is not yet clear the measures that the government is now trying to apply to end up this process. But I would like to take the opportunity to make three comments about the impact measures over the small mining sector, and I would like to hear also the thoughts of the persons speaking there, of Monica and Hannah. Clear impact or dire impact of these regulations in the coal mining sector. The first one is, I would say, a more practical operation, and it's related to something that was already mentioned, the reduction of time to the approval of the environmental impact assessment. I think that areas like Madre de Dios, for instance, also are very complex, and they are very complex not only because the presence of small activities like mining or agriculture, but also for the presence of oil projects. So, for instance, now there is a project, the Hype Oil has a 76 plot. There is a gas reserve that apparently, if I'm not wrong, is 3 times the reserves of Canisea, main gas area in Peru. So what is going to happen if we reduce the time to approve, for instance, the environmental impact assessment in areas with complexity? That's something that can bring probably social conflict and problems to the governance in the area. So this is, for instance, an example that could happen in Madre de Dios, but it could also happen in other areas. Another impact that I see directly here is that, as far as I understand, the Minister of Environment, they don't have, with these new regulations, they have less control over the zoning process. And in my perspective, at least, the zoning process was a very useful tool to start the process of ordering the mining activities in Madre de Dios. The creation of the mining corridor was done in part using the zoning process as a tool. And now that the need for environment has a lot of, let's say, power in this process, I see the risk that informal or illegal mining in other areas or in other regions of Peru where the zoning process is going very slow can even become more, can have even more problems to advance. I don't know if you follow me.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Yeah. We're listening.
And the last implication that I see is if we see, for instance, the environmental quality standards. Before the Minister of Environment, it used to take like 10 or more years to approve, for instance, an ECA or a standard. When the Minister of Environment was created, this process was faster. As Monica was mentioned, now probably the process is going to get it's going to get again like very slow. Mm-hmm. So, and my question would be like, what are the implications of this for the small miners? Because we know that the impact that they produce in terms of release, for instance, of mercury and other materials, especially in the Amazon basin, are very very important. So, the experience I've been doing research last year about small miners in Madre de Dios. The experience tells us that, for instance, before the creation of the Minister of Environment, the role of the Minister of Energy and Mining was very strong. And in part, the somehow tragedy, the environmental problems that we are living now in Madre de Dios are caused, in my opinion, due to this huge power that at some point had the Minister of Energy and Mining in Peru. And the changes that we have seen in policies since 2009 are precisely the result of the creation of a new institutionality with the Ministry of Environment. Those are my comments, and thank you for allowing me to give my opinion.
Thanks, Lennon. Just to maybe respond really briefly, I totally agree on point one. Where he was mentioning the potential for conflict between oil and gas, large operations concessions and miners, and that's already starting to emerge in Cusco and Madre Dios. In the last 6 months, there have been meetings and protests and kind of political commentary that has highlighted some maybe emerging conflict between miners and the companies that control this Block 76, which he mentioned, which also overlaps an indigenous reserve and quite a number of communities, as well as part of this mining corridor. And there's similarly also not really a mechanism for resolving or addressing those potential conflicts. And I think the standard point he brings up is important. And yes, he actually just wrote a great book that probably a lot of you have seen. And I think you make that point there too, Lennon, that I think is important, that, you know, there's a lot of this focus on the process itself of formalizing and eradicating what's illegal, but has not been as much focus on how to improve what mining is going to happen in terms of quality standards, mm-hmm. and remediation.
Yeah.
We have a question there.
Hi, my name is Susan Brown. I work with the Environmental Protection Agency, and we're actually doing some work with Peru on capacity development, capacity enhancement in the EIA and enforcement areas, mm-hmm. in connection with the free trade agreement. I have two questions from the slides. One slide you showed the environmental ministry having a 45-day period to review an environmental impact assessment, and then issue a binding or non-binding technical opinion. And I'm wondering if you're able to elaborate any more on what's in those opinions and when they do binding versus non-binding. And my other question is the appearance of these maps in the slides indicative that the country has good GIS data for the entire country?
Do you want to answer that, Yay?
Yeah, well, I can answer a little. You could, I think you have. Can you repeat the question?
Sure.
Native English speaker.
So the question first was asking for more detail on the EIA process and when binding technical opinions and when non-binding technical opinions are issued within that 45-day window, if you can clarify that decision-making process. And then the second question was about the quality of GIS data across the country in Peru.
Well, for example, there was a lot of different data layers there. And I'm just wondering if that kind of data is environmental data, but also land use data and sort of data along the lines of was shown.
Sure. Do you want to answer the EIA question?
Yeah. Well, as far as I can address the EIA question, the thing is, the EIA is a pre-activity permit. And in order to do that, sometimes they need, the certification for EIA has been kept in the sector. So it is mostly the economic sector that is in charge of doing this. They do not have the environmental tools, the technical tools sometimes, and they need to get an objective opinion on should this EIA be approved or not, is it good enough? Binding and not binding means if you go to the environmental authority and they give it, they will give you their technical appreciation, and if they say no, it's the end of the certification process. But there are also some that may be taken into account in order to approve and suggest changes to the EIA, but will not determine whether it is or not approved. So, it's a very detailed process, and there are a lot of different certifications. So I don't think we should go into one of them. Yeah, and I think maybe you have more.
The data question, Matt. Do you want to answer that? I'll hand it over to my colleague Matt, who has spent a lot of time on these data layers.
I spend all day, every day. Yeah, there's data.
But I think it's mixed and it's in a lot of different places. And so to create those maps that are sort of multi-layered requires collecting and compiling from a large number of different places, and it's in varying levels of up-to-dateness.
Yeah,
that
spend a lot of
fair.
Time trying to create good maps based on a lot of scattered info. So it's challenging.
Yeah, it is it may be useful to say that sometimes the working from the side of the government, it is hard to obtain this cross information maps. If you work in the environmental sector, you may not have the same access to mining rights. Remember the yellow blocks, the mining ministry has that very clearly, catastro for the mining. For the minority rights, however, it is not the same access, and sometimes even when you follow environmental sanctioning procedures, it is hard to determine because the mining permits are done in this little squares, but the environmental are granted over the whole area of the exploitation process, and there's a different definition for the area you're working when you're talking about where the mining rights are, where the environmental. Standards are that the areas you're working, because maybe you're not working in the whole square, and also the commercial definition of what a mining project is, they're different, and it is very hard from the side of the government, even though different agencies have the whole information, it is very hard for us to obtain whole complete information to overlap the rights and the permits that are granted over these areas. So it is I think we have the information, but we need to, like, a better communication mm-hmm. skills, and that is something I wanted to comment on what Lenin said, because I totally agree with him. And maybe this regulation does not change the standards we have for environmental protection, but it does change the processes, and what I think it affects very harshly is the government official's psyche. Like, just stating this very strict terms, you have 45 days to give a technical opinion, whether it's binding or not, and you are subject to a responsibility procedure, because if not, you're like not fulfilling your functions. That is a very harsh statement to have in a law, like directly focused to a determined government official. So that does work. And even though you may say, well, but they're not changing a lot. Other sectors were also involved before in order to approve these regulations, and they're involved now. The thing is that before they did not have to sign, it was not a supreme decree, it was only a ministerial decision, but now they do have to sign. Like, this whole regulation affects the psychology of government officials, if I may say, and that definitely affects the answers you give, the opinions, the technical analysis, the time you will be rushed to give an opinion. And I think, I mean, from working from the inside of what I've seen, it does affect.
Well, it also doesn't come with new money to ramp up resources accordingly, so that opinion could actually be given in that time frame. And I think often, you know, a huge problem is the amount of EIAs or whatever that a person is supposed to approve versus how many, you know, individuals there are to actually process that.
Not only does it not come for agencies, but right now this regulation has changed the destiny of the sanctions. When regulators impose a sanction and it is paid, they get money from it, and they thought it was an incentive to impose bigger, harder sanctions, and now they're taking that away. So it takes that away from the regulator's budget, and also it is a question that the pago por aporte por regulación. There was a payment for...
Mining companies had to pay a fee, essentially. It was like a profit percentage that was quite small. It was like 0.16 or something.
Yeah.
Pay into the OEFA to be regulated, essentially, mm-hmm. To support the system. And just since this law has come out, she's mentioned...
I think even before a little uh-huh. this law came out, they were doing a legal procedure to say that this regulation fee was unconstitutional. So it is under discussion if the regulators will keep obtaining it. The thing is, it's not been discussed before. This regulation fee has been paid before when other agencies were in charge of regulating the sector, but it is only discussed now.
Yeah, and so the new law basically says that agencies that collect fines, that they, for them to be allowed to then spend those fines as their budget, creates a perverse incentive. Mm-hmm. But they aren't applying that across everything that collects fines. So the tax agency, for example, still gets to spend the fines it collects as part of its budget. It does give an option for OEFA to get more budget through 2014, but then there's no mention, right, of 2015
yes.
or beyond.
Uh-huh. There's like an exceptional regulation that could be done to they're cutting off the budget from fines, but they do not say what's mm-hmm. going to happen for the next year. Yeah.
Can I just say that the
yes.
data layer question was we developed in the U.S. a tool called a GIA assist
mm-hmm.
that pulls data layers from all over the government and actually private sources as well. And we used it internally and within the government initially in reviewing environmental impact assessments and so on. But now we made it available, and we've deployed this tool in several Central American countries, and Chile has it as well. So I was just wondering whether it's something that might be helpful in Peru, and it sounds like from the comments it could be. So
yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Is there a question?
Yes.
Sure. You had mentioned earlier in the presentation, Monica, that of all of the
That is exactly.
So the question is that of the 5,500 violations that OFA found, only 90 sanctions were issued. And can Monica provide more detail on the reasoning behind that and sort of what the process is and how much this law then will truly change that process if not that many violations have been found?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, this data, the information, part of what the agency is speaking out regarding this regulation, and what the official talk is that it will not affect us as much. I differ, but the thing is, yes, actually OFA has been doing residual sanctioning. There has not been that excessive regulation, excessive sanctioning has not been happening. Most of the fine sanctions, if you can see, are sanctions imposed of procedures that were inherited by the previous regulation previous control agencies. So it does mean, what does this mean? We've done over 5,000 supervisions, but only 96 of them have led to sanctions. It means also that the industry is being more responsible, I guess. They're attaining better to laws and regulations. A lot of the infractions found in the supervisions have led to recommendations, have led to corrective measures, remediation measures, and only residually to sanctioning. The agency has been cautious about sanctioning, but we cannot be responsible for the procedures that we inherited from previous agencies that were possibly more, the procedures were started probably less strictly, or the supervision process was different. I do believe these regulation affects it, but what this data is supposed to show is that it has been a responsible use of power, right? Regarding sanctioning mining procedures. Not that we're not gonna be affected by it, because we've already been doing residual procedures, but that we have already been cautious, and the claims of some economic sector saying that it was an abusive use of power do not have a real grasp, how you say that? Asidero.
Real precedent there.
Yeah. So, I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay, and then I'll give Susan a chance.
Hello?
Jay. Hi, Lenin.
And I guess we have a question about
maybe he wants to comment.
Hi.
Cause that's
do you have a comment, Lenin?
Very hi.
I have a comment. I don't
great.
Know.
Yes.
Hi. I have also two original comments. I would like to make the emphasis on this, because trying to always look at the link between these measures and the small mining sector. I think Hannah mentioned it as well, but let me insist on this. I think these measures also undermine the legitimacy of the policy for formalization here. When I was working in Madre de Dios, for instance, a very common opinion you receive from miners, and not only miners, but also even actors actors from other organizations, is that the formalization process is not easy at all for small miners. And then you have these measures for instance, large scale mining. And what you perceive is some sort of probably double standard in the promotion of mining activities, like a very difficult process for the small miners, and a very, an easy process for big mining companies. So this is something that we should evaluate for the future in Peru, to see how this is going to impact the legitimacy of this policy. And the second thing that I wanted to mention is that, trying to look at the positive sides, I think we should also explore if this could be an opportunity for those miners who have been operating in a medium scale as small miners. I mean, they were legally recognized as small miners, but their production was more like medium scale. And to give you a brief example, Maria de Dios is a very diverse scenario. So we cannot say just one, there exists just one type of mining activity. The area which is more consolidated of technology, investment, capital, etc., is, for instance, Mopeque, which is in the mining corridor. And there you can find, for instance, the miners who are now in the process of formalization, but probably some of them, I would say at least 30% of them, have already operating as medium scale. So the question is if this process could allow them to enter in a new category as medium miners. Because one thing that I discussed when I was in Madrid years is that many of these miners, even if they have the capital, they are afraid of entering this new regime, in the medium scale regime, because they feel that the state doesn't give them like the opportunities or the tools for them to enter in this new level of operation. So probably if we see the positive side of this, it could be an opportunity for them to really operate at medium scale in mining. And the good side of this could be that we can have more fiscalization over these miners. And we can improve mining activities in this particular area. Because also we have to distinguish between this area and what is happening in the national reserve, which is illegal and cannot be formalized. Those were my comments.
Thank you.
My question, I think, relates to that. For those miners that may be families that have aggregated together and are actually, though they're claiming to be small, or actually medium-sized, or others that have grown to be medium-sized but have not either applied for the proper permits or have not finished the process, is there any enforcement action being taken against them?
So the question is whether or not those who are operating as, who are actually medium scale miners who are operating as if they were small and artisanal, are interdiction or enforcement efforts being taken against them currently?
Yes. Well, the first and most notorious action is interdiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because interdiction enables the government to destroy or confiscate machinery that is used for like in illegal processes. If you remember the definition of illegal and informal mining, they both have in common that they use inadequate machinery for their mining sites, and they do not comply with the technical legal standards. They may not have the mining rights, the surface right, or the environmental permits. However, informal mining is subject and under the formalization process. But those that are not participating in the formalization process, that are working in illegal areas, or that have been excluded from the formalization process because of their statements, we have been able to determine that they've aggregated, they're working on a bigger scale. They are subject to interdiction, and also they are subject to administrative sanctioning procedures at OEFA and being treated as medium or large scale miners because they exceed the hectares or the production, the daily production, or one of the requisites that are consider them as a small or artisanal miners. So that is what the government has been doing regarding the bigger ones. Yeah.
So if I can just follow up on that, and then I have a quick question. I just wanted to mention, mercury as being an important input that's going to be needed to be controlled under any circumstances, but especially now that the Minamata Convention is in place.
Yeah.
In fact, this idea of support the development of medium-scale mining is an important tactic. I don't know about Peru in particular, but generally speaking, the move is to try to get less artisanal small scale and more aggregation into medium scale mining. It permits the scale that you need in order to have more 3-3 processes. So just, you know, that's a really interesting question about, you know, is it better to do interdiction with those medium scale miners or actually try to help them into, you know, getting into scenarios so that they can become, you know, more responsible mercury-free miners. And then just a really quick clarification is, now in this formalization process, what is the role of the Ministry of Mines, if any, in the process with small-scale miners?
So the comment was just that mercury regulation eventually will need to happen and can be used as a tool to move people towards more formal mining, and that aggregation of miners into operations has been an effective tool in other places. And then the question was whether or not the Ministry of Mines has a role in the formalization process now.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Ministry of Mines is in charge of through the regional governments. Regional governments are the government authorities in charge of supervising the smaller artisanal scale. So the sworn statement and the whole process is done throughout the regional government. In the end, it is a mining permit granted by the mining sector. What was the first part about mercury? Yes, the government is discussing a regulation, but they have not settled on it yet because it turns out some of the bigger strata of mining also use mercury, so you cannot forbid the use of it in the whole industry. They have more efficient ways of using it, capturing it, and reusing it. But yes, we're due to establish regulations for control of mercury.
Well, thank you all so much for coming. Thanks to our speakers for a very engaging discussion.